So now I do get to formally introduce Emily, who was the respondent in the earlier portion of the program. Emily is an associate adjunct professor of history and international and area studies at UC Berkeley, where she also serves as chair of both the Center for Middle Eastern Studies and the undergraduate major in Middle Eastern Studies. She received her PhD in history and Middle Eastern studies from Harvard University under the direction of Susan Miller, and is the author of works including The Melach of Marrakesh, Jewish and Muslim Space in Morocco's Red City, and the forthcoming Morocco, A Jewish History from Pre-Islamic to Post-Colonial Times. I can't think of a more apt speaker to launch our midday and afternoon segment of lectures. Emily's title for her talk is The Jewish Turn in Middle Eastern Studies and Vice Versa. Emily.
Great. Well, thanks again to the organizers for bringing us here together. What I'm going to present today is something of an overview of trends in the field, a smattering of which we heard already this morning, and then try to position my own work into these. But which field exactly am I talking about? As you've already gleaned, I work on Moroccan Jewish history, as does Susan Miller, as does Sarah Levin, though Sarah more in folklore than in history. Does this constitute Sephardic studies? Well, yes and no. I promise not to bore you with a lengthy academic discursus on the uses and abuses of terminology, but I do think it is important for the purpose of this presentation, which concerns the Jews of the MENA, that term I used this morning as well, Middle East and North Africa, to note that many Jews from these areas, certainly those from Morocco, and even more certainly those from Iran, are not really Sephardic in the sense of being historically linked to Spain as the descendants of Jews who were expelled from the Iberian Peninsula in 1492. While we don't know exactly how many expulsados went to North Africa and from there often points further east, Fernand Braudel speaks of tens of thousands, and that may be a good guess, we do know that in each place Sephardic Jews settled in the MENA, they encountered local, typically long-established Jewish populations. In Morocco, this meant Berber or Arab Jews, but further east, it could mean Romaniote Jews, Kurdish Jews, Persian Jews, and so on, some of which we heard about in Susan's paper this morning. Hence, the distinction, and I think it's an important one, between Toshavim and Megorashim, the autochthonous Jews and the exiles, that is so important to MENA Jewish history and which I want to draw out a little bit further in my talk today. So let's go ahead, as Dina suggested, and problematize what we mean by Sephardic. Do we mean it in the narrowest sense, in the somewhat offensively, at least to me, called pure Sephardim, Sephardim Tehorim, who trace their lineage back to Spain, and who are increasingly the object, not surprisingly, of genetic studies? Or do we mean the broader, more inclusive category of Sephardic that encompasses all who follow the Sephardic rite, by which I mean the style of liturgy, the law, and customs that came to dominate among Jewish communities of the Middle East and North Africa, regardless of their ethnogenesis? Although I'm extremely ambivalent about the field of Jewish genetics on the one hand, and normally I'm all for inclusiveness on the other, I'm a Berkeley professor after all, I actually think the former option is less problematic than the latter. So what's wrong with an inclusive definition of Sephardim and Sephardic studies? First, as scholars, I think we should have an instinctual suspicion of any easy binaries. Dividing the Jewish world into Ashkenazi and Sephardic, as, by the way, is the practice of the Israeli state with its two and only two chief rabbis, does not allow for much nuance or internal variation on either side. And I think this goes, actually, this is something I heard Aaron say years and years ago, in a talk on Sephardic studies, that we also have to unpack what we mean by Ashkenazi, because that's not one thing either. But on the Sephardic side, we lose sight of the fact that the Sephardic rite often existed alongside or overlapping with other minhagim, with other traditions and heritages. You see this in Morocco, for example, where Jews of the Dra Valley, near the area where Sarah is talking about, maintain their own sidurim despite doing other more Sephardic things. But there is a Dra, sidur from Dra. You see it even in Israel, where if you walk down the street in a so-called Mizrahi neighborhood, again, another term I won't go into that has its issues, in these neighborhoods, you don't see Sephardic synagogues, unless they really mean Sephardic, pure Sephardic. You see Baghdadi synagogues, Aleppo synagogues, Durban synagogues, and so on. And note that I didn't say Iraqi, Tunisian, and Syrian. I mean, it's actually that local. The Toshavim and their practices are still there, is my point, even if the Israeli state tells us most recently that Ethiopian Jews are in fact Sephardic, or at least should be subsumed under the rubric of the Sephardim. Second, I think the Sephardic paradigm can lead to Eurocentrism, and this is not intended as a critique of our lovely hosts. We, in fact, had a lot of discussion about what we should call this gathering, and there was a lot of back and forth. But I do think I think we all, again, it becomes a terminological problem more than a conceptual problem in the end. But I do think that by emphasizing the Sephardic heritage of MENA Jewish communities in particular, we have historically been less able to consider these Jews as an organic part of the regions in which they lived. And I can cite several sources, again, very good sources in Jewish studies, but nonetheless the context just isn't there. Again, this is not to say that some Jews weren't pure Sephardim, certainly some were, or that Europe is irrelevant to the history of the MENA, far from it on both counts. Rather, it seems that this inherently exilic and inherently European identity can be an impediment to deep contextualization of Jews on the local level in the MENA for a variety of reasons, some of which I'll get into. Once Spain recedes as a central concern, though, MENA Jewry can be considered on its own terms. And this, I think, is exactly what is happening in the field of Middle Eastern studies now. We're currently witnessing a deluge of books, articles, even films dealing with Jewish experiences in the Middle East and North Africa in new ways, produced by scholars coming mostly from Middle Eastern studies backgrounds, hence the title of my talk today. And as for the vice versa, which I probably won't have time to get to, some of these works are also coming from Jewish studies, where Sephardic studies has traditionally been based, but I would argue that these are more the exceptional cases, in my view, proven by the fact that I think most of those people are actually in this room here, and almost all of them who do that kind of more integrated work. These days, though, if you go to the annual conference of the Middle East Studies Association, you not only have a choice between panels on specific Jewish communities, the Jews of Libya, the Jews of Iran, and so on, but just as often, and I think this is crucial, between panels on broader themes that integrate Jewish studies in meaningful ways. For example, I recently participated in a panel on varieties of Arab identity, which featured papers on Shobi, or Persian Arabs, sub-Saharan African Arabs, Christian Arabs, and Jewish Arabs. Jews can also be found in discussions of political identities in the MENA. Algerian Jews in the FLN, Moroccan Jews in the Communist Party, Iraqi Jews in the Nahda, Egyptian Jews in the Nasserist Pan-Arab movement. Discussions of colonialism and post-coloniality, deep and long-standing concerns in the field of MES, now often include Jewish dimensions in new and interesting ways. This integration of Jewish topics, actors, and agency into Middle Eastern studies is an exciting development, and I want to take now a few minutes to try and track it. And some of this work comes from a forthcoming article that Susan Miller and I are writing. The story begins with the rise of area studies in the 1950s in this country, with the transition away from Orientalism. This shift was embodied by figures like the Arabists Gustav von Grunbaum and Sir Hamilton Gibb, European scholars of Islam who immigrated to the United States during and after the war, who helped lay the foundations for Middle Eastern studies at Harvard and UCLA, respectively. Before his tenure at UCLA, von Grunbaum spent time at the University of Chicago, where he served as mentor to the American scholar Marshall Hodgson. Hodgson would eventually lobby for an interdisciplinary and holistic approach to the study of Islamic civilizations, which he termed Islamicate, the term that Dina evoked talking about Fred's work. Fred is another person who uses this term a lot, and I do too. This term that explicitly allowed for, even encouraged, the inclusion of Jews and other non-Muslim minorities in the histories of the Islamic world. The aforementioned scholars were at work in the United States when the US government in 1958 launched the National Defense Education Act in response to the Soviet Union's launch of Sputnik 1. This act, which came to be known as the Title VI program of the Department of Education, provided a significant boost to the study of foreign languages and area studies considered to be of strategic importance to the United States. As a site of proxy wars during the height of the Cold War, the Middle East and North Africa figured prominently in US foreign policy thinking. American universities were quick to leverage government interest in expanding already existing programs of scholarship on the Middle East by garnering money for graduate fellowships and establishing government-funded national resource centers for the study of the region, one of which pays my salary. In 1966, the Middle East Studies Association, MESA, whose annual conference I mentioned a moment ago, was created as an umbrella organization for the various programs springing up around the country. It has continued to serve in that capacity until the present day with, I would mention as an aside, numerous Jewish presidents to engage in some of the identity politics I recently decried. With newfound institutional support, American students began learning Arabic, Turkish, Persian, and so on as living languages. No longer satisfied to explain contemporary phenomena through the study of ancient texts, they also started traveling to the MENA itself to gain first-hand knowledge and experience. Cultural anthropologists were among the first to be drawn to Morocco specifically as a site for fieldwork. Morocco appealed to them both because of its social diversity and because it was already familiar to many young Americans who had served in the Peace Corps, which was established in 1961 and had a large presence in Morocco. Anyway, these scholars of Morocco in the 1960s through the 1980s, whether they were working in the archives or in the field, inevitably stumbled onto the story of Moroccan Jews. Jews were still an unmistakable presence in Moroccan society in those decades. They were the largest Jewish population in the Arab world and were also the best integrated, arguably. These scholars never claimed to work on Jews, per se, yet they took care not to ignore or to efface them either. For example, Lawrence Rosen's seminal work on the Middle Atlas village of Sefru, sort of on the other side of the mountains from the slide that Sarah showed us this morning, made use of the Moroccan Jewish experience as a means for better understanding complex articulations of how the broader Muslim society functioned. As he explained in a recent correspondence for the article I mentioned before, quote, "I was struck in my work with both urban and rural Berber and Arab informants by their frequent and well-disposed remarks about their Jewish neighbors and trading partners. Thus, for me, the Jews were a test case, a bounding instance of Muslim relationships and cultural concepts, a way of using these interreligious relations to understand what was central to Moroccan Muslim social and cultural life. Once the 1967 Middle East War broke out and I saw many of these relationships under stress, I was all the more taken with how the ways in which these two communities interacted could serve as an indicator of internal Muslim culture and society." Prompted in part by this emerging body of scholarship on Morocco, and also by similar work being done on Egypt, Syria, and Iraq, Jewish studies slowly began to cohere as a field of inquiry within Middle Eastern studies. But the path was not smooth. Intellectual and ideological conflicts over the role of various studies in the university curriculum arose in tandem with episodes of actual conflict in the Middle East. In this tense environment in which Israel and its neighbors clash at least once a decade, Jewish topics became marginalized or heavily politicized within Middle Eastern studies. Vicious and sometimes ad hominem debates damage the chances for any integration of the fields, with the tone set by the fierce and often vitriolic encounters between Columbia professor of comparative literature Edward Said, author of Orientalism, and the Princeton Orientalist scholar Bernard Lewis, that endured until the former's death in 2003. Nonetheless, proof that Jewish and Middle Eastern studies could be intellectually integrated came with the publication of A Mediterranean Society by Shlomo Dov Goitein, a magisterial treatment of the 300,000 Jewish manuscript fragments dating from the Middle Ages that were discovered in the Ben Ezra Synagogue of Cairo, known, of course, as the Geniza documents. Goitein's multi-volume study introduced a new paradigm of symbiosis that stressed the mutual implication of Jews and Muslims in the economic, social, and even political life of the southern Mediterranean. Above all, the Geniza documents showed how Islamicate Jews in all their variety, Karaite, rabbinic, rich, poor, and so on, enjoyed a certain cultural at-homeness that European Jewry could not, for the most part, claim to share. The post-Goitein generation was a transitional one. Some of its members remained committed to Orientalist philology and firmly grounded in Jewish studies, approaching MENA Jews primarily as part of a larger, relatively unified Jewish diaspora. Others gravitated towards interdisciplinary area studies paradigms and cultivated expertise in Arabic and other languages and Islam as prerequisites to presenting Jews as a regular feature of larger Muslim societies, albeit with unique features. They were often influenced by French postmodernism and Saidian post-Orientalism, which served as a model for breaking with their forebears. They paid special attention to the relationship between Jews and Orientalism, including the Orientalists' particular brand of anti-Semitism, leading to new insights about Jews' unique position in the colonial paradigm between colonizer and colonized, to borrow a concept from Albert Memmi. Few, if any, scholars of MENA Jews henceforth failed to make a trip to the archives of the Alliance Israélite Universelle, whose records elucidated this fraught relationship with great poignancy. And of course, Aaron Rodriguez was one of the pioneers in working in that archive. The search for new sources also led scholars to join the so-called Islamic City debates, where they made use of local documentation, maps, censuses, oral histories, and so on, and new methodologies to help restore Jews to their rightful place in the history of the region's great urban cultures. Daniel Schrader recalls this scholarly trajectory that led him to write The Merchants of Essaouira, one of the first works to inscribe Jews fully into the social topography of the North African city. And I quote Daniel, "I came to Morocco to conduct doctoral research with the intention of studying the history of Essaouira, inspired by Miège's study Le Maroc et l'Europe. At the same time, I wanted to shift the focus to the internal dynamics of Moroccan society interacting with Europe. I was interested in studying Jews and their interactions with Muslims, but did not see it as a Jewish history project per se. There were a small group of Moroccan historians and researchers working in the archives on the 19th century at the same time. The focus of many, if not most, historians in Rabat at the time was on social history of different regions. I learned a lot from this group. Many were also writing about Jews in the context of Moroccan history, which is what I was interested in doing. However, missing in these studies by the Moroccan historians was the Jewish voice, which I attempted to include, based on Jewish texts and documents in Hebrew and Judeo-Arabic." So as Schroeder notes, one of the unique and defining features of Moroccan Jewish studies is the prominence of highly trained and prominent local scholars. The influence of figures such as Ahmed Tawfiq, Mohamed Kanbib, Jean Abaida, Germain Ayesh, Simon Levy, Abdelaziz Shahabar, Omar Boum, and Mohamed Hatmi on this body of scholarship cannot be overestimated. This involvement makes Morocco a particularly attractive site for this kind of research. The university in Rabat sponsors an active working group on Moroccan Judaism. Its director was recently named the head of all Moroccan archives. Hebrew is taught in all the major universities, and a relatively unbiased treatment of Judaism is part of the standard primary school curriculum. Casablanca boasts the only Jewish museum in the Arab world. But other sites are emerging. We talked about the potential for Iran this morning. Algeria, Sarah Stein has done some work there. I think the Gulf has been understudied, but the Jewish communities of Kuwait and Bahrain, for instance, are ripe for research. So what are the advantages and challenges that we face as MENA Jewish Studies moves into the new millennium? What does this decentering of Europe get you? Well, on the one hand, it gets you greater attention to context, language studies for sure. Alongside regular Middle Eastern studies programs, students also study Hebrew, Judeo-Arabic, and or Berber languages, that is, in addition to their Arabic, Persian, Turkish, and so on. In the Maghreb specifically, context might mean expertise in Maliki and Ibadi legal traditions, those particular schools of jurisprudence, that again bring you away from these generalized notions of dhimma to how minority status was actually adjudicated on local levels in particular moments of history. Might also involve the ability to deconstruct syncretistic religious practices and rituals, like the phenomenon of joint saint veneration in Morocco. Second, one of the advantages is, I think, a new research agenda. Contemporary scholars often focus less on sort of Jews, as on the Jewish Muslim relationship and the ramifications of this relationship. And they do this using film representations, intertextual encounters, and memory, and so on. So for good or for ill, we see that postmodern sensibilities now color much of this scholarship. The study of Moroccan Jewish identity, a topic first pioneered by Daniel Schrader, has been transformed through the use of concepts such as hybridity, alterity, and the subaltern. Rather than viewing history as an isolated phenomenon or an end to itself, this scholarship often uses the Jewish experience as a unique prism through which to study both Middle Eastern states and societies, as well as multivalent MENA nationalisms in a more nuanced and textured fashion. But at the same time, it also highlights the legacy of these so-called Mizrahi Jews in their countries of origin, and in turn facilitates a deeper understanding of Mizrahi struggles in contemporary Israel. This new research agenda has been abetted not only by the increasing accessibility of archival materials, but also by a willingness to reopen closed dossiers and to examine them in a new, more searching light. There are, of course, also challenges and difficulties associated with these cultural and historiographical shifts. First, what gets lost in the process? So in the absence of a Shlomo Dov Goitein or an Ignaz Goldzier, I think we have lost some of the attention to religion and religious texts that we once had in the field. This is not entirely surprising, given that the shift to Middle Eastern studies is typically a shift away from Jewish studies. With a few exceptions, and people like the anthropologist Oren Kazansky comes to mind, as does the legal scholar Lina Salema, it's proven very hard to cultivate expertise in both context and text. A larger challenge is the continued politicization of the field and related problems of access. What resources and sources are available for researchers, and in which archives? How can we reconstruct and study archival politics? How is our research agenda shaped by political discourse in Europe, in America, in the Arab world, in the broader Islamic world, and in Israel? And how, in turn, does it inform such discourse? While I've tried to highlight the process of integration of these fields, the problem of non-integration has also not been solved by any means, and it's double-edged. Not only are Jewish questions or issues still often missing from contexts in which they squarely belong in Middle Eastern studies, but this gap mirrors a similar problem in Jewish studies, leaving many of us who do this kind of work out in the cold, less so than in the past, but still some of us are out in the cold, or at least feeling a little chilly. That is, from the purview of Middle Eastern studies, Jewish studies, despite significant progress in recent years, remains pretty Eurocentric once you get beyond late antiquity. This situation is the result of very different trajectories of each field and aren't necessarily linked or two sides of the same coin, except to the extent that we want to bring the elephant in the room into our discussion. Integrated histories, diasporist studies, are by definition non-Zionist. to the extent that Jewish studies is Zionist and Middle Eastern studies anti or non-Zionist, and of course never things are never so black and white, I'm talking about perceptions, of course, the marginalization of the kind of work we do is the result of such linkages, justified or not. Thus, it's not surprising that in my field, Moroccan Jewish history, it's the most prominent nationalist historian, Abdallah Larawi, who most ignores Jews. While this may be ultimately unsolvable as a problem, there are still good and worthwhile strategies for promoting integration of the two fields that I'd like to finish my talk with. First, I would promote thematic research rather than Jewish microhistories or, God forbid, studies of exotic communities. Go where the Jews were and where they still are in many cases in the Middle East and North Africa. And they weren't only in synagogues by a long shot. Using this strategy, we're beginning to register important and often surprising research findings on once occulted topics such as interwar political conflicts, the period of Vichy rule, which Susan will talk about later this afternoon, and the role of Jews in the region's nationalist and communist movements. Second, promote research on Jews in the Middle East and North Africa itself. Collaborate with colleagues overseas. If you're in a position to do so, help them get the training they need, particularly in social sciences. Here, again, is where Moroccanists are at a great advantage because this has already been happening for a while now. Something I've been trying to do is conduct a survey of Jewish studies in the Arab and Islamic world, and where can one study Hebrew, where can one study Jewish history, and so on. And there are some surprising results. I mean, Saudi Arabia is one place where you can do fair, well, you can certainly do Hebrew, and there in Riyadh now is a Jewish Studies Institute. Egypt, of course, Tunisia, Morocco, Jordan, and so on. So, let's cultivate those relationships. To conclude, those of us studying Middle Eastern and North African Jews are in the process of mapping out our own small yet significant space in the American Academy. However, fledgling, the field of MENA Jewish studies is characterized by vigorous debate, a new generation of scholars, some of whom we saw this morning, and the promise that Jews will remain an integral part of Middle Eastern and North African history writ large for a good while to come. Thank you.
Sure, I'm happy.
So we have some time for questions or comments for Emily. I'm happy to facilitate.
Fred, do you want to start with the comment? Or we'll save them for the end.
Save them for the end.
Okay.
Sarah.
Thanks, interesting. I mean, it strikes me as strikes me so palpably how we return to the problematic with which you began, which is also the center of my talk, actually, the slippery nature of Sephardic studies as a category. And we think about your examination of MENA as a field. What falls out is Southeastern Europe. Mm-hmm. So you have Ottoman Jewry in the Eastern Mediterranean. You have the Arabophone Jewish. You have some Jewish communities that had Judeo-Spanish, in Alexandria or elsewhere. But it's very interesting that, in a way, very little of the intellectual arc that you describe and the institutional arc that you describe, except for the contemporary problematics, applies to the history of that field. And how ironic, given that the umbrella is Sephardic studies, mm-hmm. when that's the population, in some sense, that as historians, we might first think of, exclusively.
No, not exclusively.
And I think the other thing that falls away, which is very interesting, is a kind of extra Sephardic diaspora. So what happens to those communities? And of course, work is being done on this, who have left Middle East, North Africa, Southeastern Europe, where, what have you, to go to, wherever,
South America,
Chicago, Brazil, Mexico, United States, and there are these added nuances of complexity and institutional intellectual alienation when we think of a future of Sephardic studies that hopefully takes those sites seriously. Mm-hmm. So it's just, I don't disagree with anything that you've said, but my comment isn't meant to suggest that, but to say rather that if we even step back a few steps further, the elements of exclusion are actually even vaster still. And what a gulf exists within this broad framework of Sephardic studies, really between a field of Maghrebi studies, let's say, and Ottoman, focusing on Geo-Spanish, Southeastern European, heartlands.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also not included in the European story.
Right.
European as it is.
Yeah.
So it's just very fascinating.
No, I agree completely. And I mean, again, you also get, when you're dealing with Morocco, it was not part of the Ottoman world. So these communities that you get in the Ottoman, if you're doing Ottoman Jewry, all of a sudden Morocco's not there either. So it's how you slice the pie. And in 2016, we seem to be, the Middle Eastern studies is this thing that wasn't there before and may not be here. We're moving, even in the academy, we're moving away from Arab studies anyway, just as Jewish studies is coming in. But you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm speaking from my perspective as a North African, and there's very little, I read very little on the Balkans because it's just not that relevant for me. I read much more, on West Africa.
Of course.
Yeah.
Which, in a sense, my point was really to say, yes, that it gives lie to the unity of this notion of Sephardic studies, which both Jewish studies and Middle East studies are kind of inching towards accepting. At the same time, those of us who do it think, not really.
Well, it's getting us to think, and these divisions, they're conventions, they illuminate as much as they obscure, and at some point they stop being useful. I think, as Dina was saying this morning, there is still something useful in Sephardic studies, and we have to figure out what that is, and maybe just avoid these kind of hegemonies that we do. Thanks.
Just a quick question about the rich musical tradition, and the Roman Saros. I mean, just such a huge poetic and musical tradition, which is still very much alive. Is that part of or thought to be relevant to the kinds of studies that you're talking about as a source of information?
Sure. I mean, ethnomusicology is really an important field. I don't happen to work on it. That's why you didn't hear it now. I'm sure Sarah could talk about it within folklore, at least. There are people doing it, but I know that here at UC Berkeley, I come in and help advise a lot of students who are doing ethnomusicological studies of North African Jews and their relation to Andalusian music and so on.
I wanted to ask a linguistic question. I'm unclear. I just got hold of the Handbook of Jewish Languages, which was published in October. I got it in January. It lists 23 Jewish languages, including Judeo-Arabic, Jewish Berber, Judeo-Turkish, Judeo-Syriac, a couple of Iranian dialects. What is spoken in Morocco specifically? Is it Judaism or is it Judeo-Berber?
Or both. Judeo-Arabic. But the Judeo-Spanish that's spoken there is Hektia, which is its own particular dialect. And Susan Miller can sort of talk about more about that because it's spoken in the north. In the areas where I work, it's more Judeo-Arabic, which is it's more like Arabic with a Jewish accent. It's not as distinct as Yiddish is, say, from German. A Muslim would have no trouble understanding it. It would just, be some nonsense. And then there are different Berber languages, right? That's one thing I wanted to mention to Sarah, that in these kinds of different Berber dialects, correct. But also to mention that Berber also is not one thing, and so it would depend where someone.
John Hayes told me that he had actually taught a class in Judeo-Arabic in the last 10, 12 years.
Yeah,
which really surprised me.
Who was that?
John Hayes
from
the Semitics Department.
Here?
At Cal.
Yeah, but
Judeo-Arabic is really a vast number of languages,
sure,
both chronologically and geographically,
of course,
and even in Morocco, like the. I talk a lot in the dissertation, could bring it up to the top, but in the Atlas, the Jews often spoke Arabic rather than Berber, even though they were bilingual, and that varied from region to region to region, and I even worked with people who had grown up in Casablanca, couldn't speak with their grandparents, mm-hmm, because it was such a different Arabic and not understand, and I was told by
And then the written languages are also very different. So Jews in North Africa tended to very rarely wrote in Arabic script at all.
That's
so
what I was
going to
ask. So they wrote Arabic in Hebrew
characters. In Rashi characters.
Of course.
Yeah. Whereas in Iraq, in later periods, Jews wrote in Arabic script much more.
Thank you so much.
Any other final comments or questions for Emily?
I guess I had one. Just a quick one. I was surprised. I don't think I heard you suggest Mediterranean. Is that a possibility? And what is gained and lost by, I guess, people aren't on the coasts?
I guess what's lost is you know, if you work on North Africa, the sort of the Pax Islamica is so important, and you lose that. You lose the further Eastern Islamic world, which I think is really important. Iran, for me, is always the big question mark. I feel like when I'm asked to teach about Iran, this is so different, yet it gets thrown in, and it requires such specialization. So I sometimes would, you know, the Ottoman Empire, I can, you know, get my head around. Iran seems almost like that's the limit somewhere over there.
The field.
Yeah.
One more comment or question, Fred.
I don't know why I'm uncomfortable.
Because it's me and you.
It's partly because I'm a pre-modern historian.
Yeah, yeah.
So you mentioned Goetheine as a kind of a watershed. And if I reflect on Goetheine's work, both in Jewish studies and Middle Eastern studies, since the first volumes came out in the 60s, I think that scholars of the medieval Middle East are just starting to read. And I know when I was in graduate school with Naomi that nobody was reading Goetheine except Jewish studies people. Mm-hmm. It was from the Middle Eastern studies point of view, it was a niche, it was a corner.
Mm-hmm.
And so one that makes me question the not the appearance of symbiosis, but how symbiosis becomes part of a larger conversation in among Muslim scholars. What's really interesting today is that the Geniza has kind of come to the attention of people who are working on other questions around Fatimid, Ayyub, and Mamluk history, finally, but it's taken really a generation and a half. The one thing that the Geniza offers is that it reminds us that from inside Jewish studies that there's a whole world that kind of comes into view at a moment that we had no idea existed. And we need to be careful that there are other worlds out there that we don't know about looming outside of our sources, outside of what we can know. When the Geniza is used for its best, I'm thinking of the work of Jessica Goldberg, she and I think Jessica, I can't really speak for her, but I think she thinks of herself more as an economic historian than a Jewish studies person.
Mm-hmm.
She has taken the Geniza, using all this Jewish stuff, but she's really talking to us about economic systems and networks, and she's really, her book tells us that the Geniza merchants are recreating a portion of the Roman Mediterranean economic network. And so this is about kind of taking the stuff, these Jewish sources, and then integrating them into the larger historical and other contexts that make sense to scholars outside of Jewish studies. And I think, Sarah, your work on feathers is a great example of that, though not pre-modern.
Mm-hmm.
So people outside of Jewish studies can be interested in that. But when I give papers of Jewish studies, people aren't interested. And when we give papers at Mesa, if it's a whole panel of Jewish studies, nobody comes. But if you're embedded in a panel, then you get some traction.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in a kind of inchoate way, I'm talking about my discomfort with the arc you've drawn.
I mean, I guess I think it's still a process, and I would say the publication of the Mediterranean Society didn't. So it's not so much that it was scooped up then by people doing Middle Eastern studies who then transfer into Jewish studies. I don't think that's anywhere in the trajectory yet. What I think is happening is people with an interest in Jewish questions are being trained differently. It's not that practitioners of Middle Eastern studies mid-career are waking up and discovering Jews. It's not that yet. There are a few cases, but I think we're not quite there yet. And I think that Goitein's work opened up the possibility, and that possibility still is with us. And you're right, I don't think it has been completely exploited in the way it could be. So to an extent, I share your discomfort, but it's a direction that I think is undeniable. I mean, when you go to these conferences, as I've been over 20 years, where, you know, before there was nothing on Jews, then you would get some kind of ghettoized things on Jews. Now you do see more and more Jewish topics integrated into larger Middle Eastern themes, important Middle Eastern themes.
But sometimes with nationalist agendas on the part of...
Yeah, I'm not even going to get into that, of course. Yeah. Not necessarily, but sometimes, sure, like at any conference where anyone who has a
This is not a question, this is really a comment. I think as scholars, we tend to gravitate toward paying attention to structure and where we fit into particular structures that are already existing. We're trained to do that from our earliest babyhood, that we become what our mentors represent, and they very often represent people who have succeeded in certain structures. And I think what Emily's trying to say, at least this is what I'm taking from your comments, Emily, is that we're now in a state of flux. We're in a process of creating new fields, and it's the scholars who are actually in these fields who are taking charge and imposing a new way of thinking about the material we work with on the fields in general. In a sense, creating our own new structures that exist either subsumed under others, or fit into the interstices between things that already exist. And I do see, very much in my own extensive lifespan, a great deal of a change in this direction. Balkan studies, they're also a hybrid and not well-developed field within the field of Ottoman studies. So how can we expect the Jewish Balkan studies would have much traction? But Balkan studies are, if I'm not mistaken, growing within, but the hybridity of it is difficult for some people to work with. But I do see at Mesa conferences now papers and panels on the Balkans, usually on this theme of multiculturalism and hybridity. I'm sure the Jewish studies will follow once the idea is in place that this is legitimate activity. We are a timid bunch, we scholars. We don't like to be trailblazers or makers of new things, but I think in this case,
I think we're really in a transitional moment, and just sort of there is a migration. Unfortunately, it does seem like it's from Jewish studies instead of doing both. But from Jewish studies and Middle Eastern studies, I mean, you can talk about, I mean, Sarah and I've had lots of discussions about which conference do you go to? Do you go to AJS or do you go to Mesa? And that's a defining, that defines your career in some way. And I think, you know, between us, we're trying to create these synergies, but I mean, this context is a really wonderful place to talk about where do practitioners who are trained in Jewish studies meet practitioners who are trained in Middle East studies? You know, what can we do, you know, what can we do to work together and so on? I mean, it's an interesting moment.
Thank you, Emily.